Welcome to TA1, everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and then some. I'm your host, Legendary Randy Erickson, and happy Thanksgiving. Look at this, I get you a new podcast for all your travels this weekend. And it's a very delightful one also. I think you might actually be inspired to buy Erica's book, which there will obviously be a link in the show notes for. But she was very delightful to chat with, and I hope you guys are entertained. Are you not entertained? I think so. So almost Thanksgiving. That means I can start listening to Christmas music. Just about long enough to get tired of it. No, I like that. For those of you that are rationing them out, I'll probably have two more new episodes after this, before the end of the year, or before Christmas, and take a little break. Got some ideas in the hopper for next year, so we'll keep her rolling. Remember, I'm always looking for guests. You don't feel bad. You know what? You can send me a message and say, hey, I'd like to be on. So. Those are my favorite kind because then I don't have to do any work. So, all right, let's get this on the road because you're probably on the road. And, so remember, slow is fast. Go with confidence. Fake it till you make it. Happy Thanksgiving and thanks for listening. Bye.
There you are.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Yay! Okay. Is there an echo?
Yeah, but there's one on my end too, so we're okay.
Okay. Hi.
Oh, hiya. How are you?
I'm fighting off the builders. We have some builders in our complex because in South Africa we live in little communes because it's too unsafe to live in houses like where you are. So we have builders here and they are making a racket. So that's why I'm a bit late. I'm sorry. I've been chasing them to get done. Yeah.
No problem. I just put my earbuds in and I just, because I'm at work too. So I just keep working and then I totally. Answer the phone.
Yeah. They're not really bothering me, Randy, but they may bother you. So that's why I was trying to get rid of them.
So
I have this little speaker. If I plug it in, shall we try and see if there's less echo?
You can try it, yeah.
I may lose you, so it's a risk.
Yeah, we can get going.
Shall we
again.
Do it?
Yep.
Okay, let's try. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there's actually maybe a little more echo.
Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, I don't know what's going on with my system. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I think we should just work with this then.
It's, what I have discovered, and it's kind of the reason that I started it. If I have an interesting guest, and I think you are, the sound is okay. It doesn't matter.
Okay, let's try it then. Let's see what we can do.
Exactly. So we'll start with a simple question. Who are you?
Oh, in the world. Okay, Randy's, let me not tease. I would say that I'm an adventurer at heart and an outdoor enthusiast. So I think all my sporting pursuits that I've ever pursued in my life has really been a quest for nature and for really connecting with nature. So I am many things around that pivot. So shall we walk around the pivot and see what we find?
Yes, we are. And just remember, nobody wants to listen to me. They want to hear you. So
that's a pity. Okay, but I mean I'll try and keep it interesting. So I grew up on a farm in Africa. And I think that's where my love for nature started. And for 30 years I was quite content hiking. Exploring all the big trails in South Africa and abroad, just, really happy to not compete in any sport until, of course, I discovered adventure racing. And, you know, I think fundamentally things changed for me then, because when I discovered that extraordinary sport where you run and hike and cycle and kayak right through the night, day and night and day and night, it was the kind of nature immersion I used to know as a child on the farm. And it was something I really longed for and wanted to get back to. And adventure racing was the best vehicle. So when I was about 30 years old, I actually started my sporting career. Before that, there was not a semblance of an athlete in me. You know, I loved the outdoors, but I wouldn't say I was athletic in any way. And then when I discovered adventure racing, my first race was a 24-hour race in the Drakensberg in South Africa. And it was just extraordinary, you know. My first race, it was about 3 a.m. in the morning when I realized I was in deep trouble, because I could see a lifelong addiction happening. Yeah. And so after that race, I really committed my entire life to adventure racing for 5 years, and did some extraordinary races. And you know, it was in the beginning period of adventure racing when it was still a bit wild west, especially in South Africa, around about 2002 or so. And the race directors were inexperienced. The natural areas where we raced were wild and rugged and very dangerous. So it was quite an exciting time for people to start adventure racing in South Africa.
So, I mean, and we'll kind of get to it, but you're not really an adventure racer right now. You're a racer who does adventures, but do you think that was more fun back then when it was so wild and, you know, just a little more crazy than other things?
You know, I actually stopped adventure racing quite a long time ago, in 2007. After my team and I managed to go to World Champs and supporting South Africa, you know, it was a huge honor to support our country at the World Championships in New Zealand. But even then, things started changing, you know. In the first 3 years, it was extraordinary because it was wild. We raced for the love of the sport. We raced for the adventure, not the racing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we didn't have a manager, but later we would get a manager. We would get people who would do, you know, social media for us and fundraising. And we had sponsors like Salomon and, I mean, the big cycling brands. So we really had to begin to take it very seriously. And even then things started changing. And I think that's probably why I left adventure racing, because it became a little bit more about the racing and less about the adventure, you know?
Yeah. And then I think it kind of went back maybe 10 years later, 17, 18, it went way to the adventure side again and a little less the racing. And now I think it's moving back and maybe finding that sweet spot between adventure and racing. But it's very interesting that it's a sport that can do that. You can have a race that's just like, ooh, are we ever going to finish? Or sometimes it's like, we got to go really, really hard to finish this thing. So
completely. And I mean, so if you look at the finishing statistics in those early years in South Africa, I think if 10% of the field finished, it was a lot, you know. And you just knew it was going to be extraordinary. It was going to be big. And I mean, many things happened. Like, for example, in one race, we'd been racing for 3 days and three nights. And you know what it's like when the sleep monsters set in, right? Mm-hmm. And we came to it was up in the Lesotho Highlands in South Africa. And there's a very big river, the Orange River, and it was in flood. And we had the option of swimming this river in flood or doing a 20-kilometer detour to the nearest bridge. And as we were standing on the bank of the river, trying to make a decision, big logs were being swept down the river, trees, and then a cow came past, still well alive and lowing. And then one of my team members, I think the prospect of hiking an extra 20Ks was just too much. He leapt into the river, swam across, and we followed. And, you know, it was just small things like that, moments where I think moments that one would very rarely experience in one's civilian life or in sporting life. And also because the race directors, of course, they put the necessary things in place for safety. But, you know, when you're out there in the wilderness, it's really hard to have very, very rigid health and safety requirements. So the number of times we've had hypothermia, the number of times where we were really lucky to escape with our lives intact. I mean, it's inordinate probably for a sport. But I guess that's what adventure racing is all about, pushing the boundaries, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, because people like you are nuts. So yeah, of course it's fun.
Yeah, but you must have interviewed hundreds of adventure racers, and I think they could regale you with all sorts of tales. And so the interesting thing, maybe something else, a different perspective that I can bring is, so I really poured my heart and soul into adventure racing, did a lot of adventure racing, pretty much every third weekend, a 250-kilometer race, and then maybe three or four times a year, a proper 500-kilometer race, and which takes 5 to 6 days, you know, actually just on the racing, never mind getting there. But after the 5 years in adventure racing, I then took a side step into trail running and long distance trail running, and obviously endurance-based trail running, and just experiencing the very easy slipway that adventure racing created for me, to be able to step into trail running. Because, you know, if you have to run 100 kilometers, but you know tonight you're going to sleep, it's so fundamentally different to an adventure race where you run 100 kilometers or a hike, and then you get onto your bicycle, and then after 12 hours you get onto your kayak, and maybe 14 hours later you get back on your feet and so forth, and sleep comes after 72 hours, you know. So it really created for me an outer boundary of what is possible and what is comfortable that I think no other sport could have, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the magic of adventure racing. It just completely, in a nutty way, reframes what is possible, you know?
Yep. Yeah. So when my wife did... No, I was going to say, when my wife did her first 200-mile run, the Tahoe 200, our joke was, it's on a trail that's marked and there's support. How easy is that?
Completely. And you don't have to carry your stuff. And actually, you're not, And you can have the right gear, and you're not going to get wet in the middle of the night. And you can sleep.
Yep.
I mean, that's the, somebody asked me today for a little bit of advice. I actually launched my book yesterday. So it was quite a wonderful function. And one of the people who came to the function is running a 200 kilometer now. And she said, well, what should she do? Should she sleep or not? And I said, absolutely not. 200 kilometers does not warrant sleeping. You know? Anything you can finish under 48 hours, if you snooze, you lose, basically. So it's just, but I would never have had that insight from trail running. I could only ever have had that insight from adventure racing. And I mean, you must have done your fair share, and it sounds like your wife. I don't know if your wife has done adventure racing as well, but you know the sport and that it's
So nothing. She's the racer now. I'm the not racer.
right.
So my background was basically bike racing, you know, road racing for many years, and then endurance mountain bike racing, and then it's like, you know, I could take this camera and I could still be out there and not have to work near as hard. So, but yeah, she's the racer. She she actually didn't adventure race for a long time. She broke her back and her neck racing.
Wow.
So like it took a while. Yeah. Like a 10 mile an hour fall off a mountain bike, but the wrong way. So,
oh, wow.
But I, you know, she's obviously better, but so she just ran for a lot of years and then did, you know, like gravel bike and bike packing. Right. And now starting this year and next year, she's like, yeah, some. So she's back into adventure racing. She's got like 3 races already for next year. So.
Yeah, you see, that's the problem, right? Once it's bitten you, it's for life. And I knew on that first 24-hour race, like your wife, maybe she has broken her back and it took her 5 or 10 years to come back. But back, you will go back. It's just, it's a fait accompli. We can't help it.
Yeah.
And I think it's because in these sports, we touch the extraordinary. We touch something that is so outside of the norms of normal life. You know, I mean, there was another moment that I so distinctly remember also on a 5-day race in the Drakensberg again. And it's kind of 3,000 meters altitude and there are wild horses in the Drakensberg. And my team and I summited somewhere in the early morning hours, maybe 2 a.m. And there was a pack of wild horses in the mist. And they stopped and they watched us and we stopped and we watched them. And maybe it only lasted for about 2 minutes before the horses turned on their heel and galloped away. But I'll never forget that moment of real contact, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, it really helps if you haven't slept for 3 days, and then it's sort of super attenuated.
are those really horses? Are you guys seeing horses over there?
You know, exactly. Is that really horses? But why is my captain dressed in a tutu? We had lots of that. The good old sleep monsters. And it was free, right?
Yep. Do you find it when you were specifically adventure racing that it condensed everything, like you know a day of adventure racing is like 6 months in real life condensed in, you know, all the emotions, the connections you make with people. I mean
that's such an inviting question, because I think that's why when you race extensively and you do something like 4 5-day races in a year, I think it's completely character changing, because those experiences that you squeeze into 5 days, I think you go into a completely different realm of being in the world, of engaging. I think you're just stripped to the absolute skeleton of yourself, to the root brute core. Right, it's like X-ray vision. You can see right through yourself to the, there's nothing hidden. The veneer is gone. It's been ripped off. Yeah. And exactly as you say, the connections and the friendships that you make and actually how you engage with each other is so much more real than in normal life, that I think if you took somebody in before they get married, they should probably do an adventure race together, because it's the equivalent of spending 6 months one-on-one full-time together.
Yeah.
And it is quite a profound experience. And also, I mean, Randy, you know this, the emotions that get stirred when you are so vulnerable together in a group. And then on top of that, going through really dangerous stuff, having to completely entrust your life to somebody else. And then on top of that, the vulnerable, completely honest to the core engagement with other people, you know, and then you've got these superlative nature experiences in these epic area nature landscapes. I mean, it's actually, that's why it's addictive, because it's life on steroids, and like you say, absolutely condensed. So I haven't adventure race now for probably, haven't done an adventure race for 6 years or maybe even more. But I often think about it and long back for it, you know, And I get my kicks through long distance running and where you go through the night. But there's something else that you enter when you've not slept for 2 days and two nights. And you're actually walking behind somebody holding his backpack and you are fast asleep on your feet walking, trusting this person who is actually not a person anymore because you become one organism. That's the other interesting thing I found. It's almost like your identity is lost a little bit as an individual and you become an organism of four almost gender neutral, you know, anonymous. You become a creature.
Yeah.
The four of you, you know, really tuned into each other's rhythms. And I could hear if a guy walked behind me and he had hit a sugar low, because it was three guys in my team and one woman. So yeah. I could hear when one of the boys had hit the sugar low, because I was so attuned to them. And also especially my captain, because he was navigating. And when you've got all that on you, you very rarely have the luxury of tuning into your own system and listening when you should eat, when you should dress. So, you know, I could tune in for them in a way, you know?
It may actually be the pinnacle of a team, adventure race teams. I mean, you literally become one. I mean, I guess that would be a team, right?
Well, they also say that's a good marriage. So
yeah.
But actually, that is a good team, and it's interesting if you have people who are very, very strong in the team. I mean, you know, people maybe at Kona Ironman level, top 10 type of people. And everybody in the team is not of more or less equal strength. And you get four really strong individuals. It could actually make a weaker team than, I wouldn't say average, but people might be not of that absolute world-class level who gel together better. It's a team sport. It's not a sport of four highly talented sporting individuals. It's not. That's the magic of adventure racing. And I think that's why it's so profound. And that's why, even if it's so unbelievably taxing on your life, because you know it is the ultimate mistress. She takes everything, your money, your time, your energy, sometimes your health for short periods. But the truth is that's why we do it, because it gives us this extraordinary taste of what it could be like in superdrive, you know, in overdrive.
True. So I have to ask this. I ask this a lot of times, and it's a simple yes or no question, but are there things that your teammates know about you that your partners don't?
I have to think at the time when I was racing. No, because my partner seconded for us.
Okay.
And you know the seconds when they sit. I don't know what the format is exactly, but I guess in the US it can take so many different formats. But in South Africa, because we have such vast areas where there's no civilization, you know, no, it's wild. We have to drive really, really far for these races. And very often what is required would be two seconding teams with two 4x4s, right? So you have two 4x4s, two seconding teams, and they literally drive thousands of miles in one race to get to every checkpoint. And they go through their own hell of sorts, you know, having to sit with your stinky, filthy shorts and longs on the radiator for hours and hours on end, so that you have dry pants on you when they see you next. So we were very close. My partner was one of the seconds. So I think, you know, the whole team was very close.
Yeah, that's cool. So do you get anywhere near that closeness in 6 day races, running races, because you're with the same people relatively, you know, sort of.
Definitely or is not. It definitely, is it, definitely no. Okay. You get so if you had to compare it to how close do you get to your colleagues in the boardroom, then go on it. So the answer is not. Boardroom, nothing ever happens. Then you go on a 6 day race and the connections are superlative. You really connect, you know, you're still suffering together. At the end of the day, you lie around in the gazebo tents, you talk and talk and talk and talk. But I'm not going to say it's easy. These races are also taxing, but they are not even a fifth as taxing as adventure racing, and they don't strip you raw the way adventure racing does. So there is still a degree of separation. Also because you don't race as a team, right? You race as an individual. But also the connection that happens, there is a degree of separation still when adventure racing. When you have been awake with somebody going nonstop, day and night and day and night and day and night, through some really harsh conditions, you know, through sleet and snow and frost and rain, the veneer has been washed off. So the kind of connection and the depth of the connection is very different. It's almost at a visceral level, at a physical level. You know, like I said, one organism where you begin to tune into each other and it's different. It's almost beyond words. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we sit under those gazebos on 6 day trail runs and, you know, we shoot the breeze all day long and we chat and we laugh and we make jokes. But in adventure racing, you go to a place beyond that where the fatigue is so great that you enter something that is actually beyond words. It's a different kind of energetic connection that's hard to describe if you've not been there. And the other thing is, what is interesting is, and I don't know if this has been your experience, but sometimes those connections aren't transportable in that form into daily life, you know? So it's not possible to be that close to somebody when you get back home. It's almost that, like you leave it for the field because you can only get to that place in the field. So you do become good friends, but it's almost like you need downtime from each other so that you can have those really intense connections. You know, so you won't be hanging out every week. And if you're not training, you give each other a bit of a break, you know?
Yeah. So, well, that could
I don't know. Was it like that for you? Or?
Well, I was actually never an adventure racer, but I totally understand that much compressed emotion and feelings and stuff. You'd have to have a break from that. Yeah, you couldn't do that 24/7, 365, as the kids say. That'd be way too much.
No, I think one would actually need some serious professional help eventually if that had to be the case. No, you know, you have to come away from, and I mean, I reflect on the period, the week or 2 weeks after a 5 day race where you've literally touched, you know, the vault of heaven, or I don't know how to describe this place that you go to, this superlative way of existence. And then when you come off it, it's hard because now you're stepping back into life as normal. The cortisol and adrenaline is draining out of your system at the speed of the Niagara waterfalls, and you hit a low like you have never seen, like Neil Armstrong when he's been to the moon and came back, and what now, you know? It's physiological, it's emotional, it's maybe even to some extent slightly spiritual, because now you and life is normal and you're having a physiological reaction from all the stuff leaving your body. But there's also a sort of an echo in life. It doesn't really feel real, you know, life is normal. So the aftermath of these races is actually quite hard, and people when they adventure race, and even distance running, it's the same. Perhaps not as intense, but anything from a week to 3 weeks after the event, expect to be coming down like a, you know, kamikaze.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's even from my perspective, you know, on the other side of the camera, just watching, it's, yeah, you always come home and it's like, well, real life sucks. Let's go have some more fun.
Yeah, but I think it's something about that, but, you know, it's really also because I think if you've gone, I suppose, you know, if you ask anybody who takes substances, they will tell you that you go, you know, after the high comes the low. You know, it's probably natural that you have to, when you go that high, because it is a kind of high when you adventure race. Yeah. And this whole, the effect of not sleeping for so many days and being in such close proximity to another human being and then going through really exciting experiences together, it's absolutely just natural that afterwards life would feel a little dull, I suppose.
Yeah, it did. So let's move into the running, because I find this pretty fascinating too. Did you, I mean, you ended up being pretty good, right? I mean, we can say that.
Right. Thank you.
Did you expect that, or was it a surprise, or did it, you get started going and think, oh, I can be, I'm pretty good at this and even work harder? How did that all pan out for you?
Okay, that's a really good question. So Randy, I moved to the UK shortly after I ended my adventure racing. Well, I basically stopped adventure racing because I moved to the UK, because I was racing for South Africa's top team. And then took about a year off in the UK, didn't do any sport really, except for, you know, a bit of running just to keep fit. And then, you know, I'm just going to go all in. Why not? Then I got divorced. And yeah, at the end of my divorce, I think because adventure racing had given me so incredibly much in my life, the first thing, like reaching for a lifeboat, the first thing I reached for was an extreme sport event. It was an emergency. I didn't have time to look for a team and look for an adventure race. I needed to go, and I needed to go now.
Yeah.
And I've always been drawn to the big deserts of the world, because there's something extraordinary also about those vast expanses where there's nothing, seemingly nothing, but it's not really like that. And so I discovered that Racing the Planet was hosting a 7-day race in the Sahara. And I knew this was my ticket to recovery from, you know, to heal from my divorce and from, you know, the difficulties that come afterwards. And I went to the Sahara. I had an ITB injury, the itibial band injury. why, I don't know, because I wasn't really running extreme distances at all. And I remember telling my mom at Heathrow while I was in the check. In queue, I phoned my mom and I said, I'm still going to go, but I'm just going to walk it because I can't run at all and because of the injury. And on the first day of the desert run, I started trotting, and the trotting was fine. And then it hit 50 degrees Celsius heat, and I loved it. I loved the heat. So, I mean, I was just coming from the UK and being Antipodean, I really missed Africa in the sun. And the race director came past at about 35 k's and hollered at me to keep going because I was the first lady home by a long shot. And I just ran, and the next day I just continued running, and the ITB didn't come back. I think in the end I beat the next lady by 17 hours or something ridiculous like that. I had no idea I had it in me. I just ran and ran and ran, and I loved every moment of it and made really extraordinary friends on the trip. And the desert was a great place for one's heart to be after a life disappointment. You know, perhaps that boosted the running as well. So I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea. I had it in me, but my first ever long distance desert race, it was the sweetest thing ever.
This is maybe not a fair question, but what the heck? Do you think you could have done that well if you hadn't been coming off this huge life disappointment?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because I think I did really well in that desert race because I didn't care about the racing. I ran with all my heart and all my soul. I was just legs and heart, you know, and I didn't care who was in front of me and I didn't care who was behind me. It was my thing and my business. And I think when you released from the competitive pressure, and I can now speak about it because that was 10 years ago and I've done a lot of races since. And that sweetness of not having any kind of competitive pressure, I didn't quite ever experience it again.
Yeah.
Because once you start doing well and people expect you to do well and then you've got pressure and it's not the same. So I think absolutely, yes, I did well in that race because my mind was preoccupied with other life stuff.
Once you have some success and like you say, you sort of get this target on you, you know, you're the one that they're pointing at and like, she's fast.
Yeah.
Is it as fun when you're the top dog, or is it a little more stressful?
Yeah, I personally, I mean, it depends what you're motivated by. I think for some people, it's a huge rush and a kick. And they actually do well out of that because they like being the rabbit's tail that everybody chases. But I'm not motivated that way. Like I said to you, for me, right from the beginning, it was being in nature and being in nature in an extreme way is what I really wanted. So as the competitive pressure mounted, I really didn't like it. It didn't play to my strength, to my strengths or my how I'm wired. So the best races I ever did were the races where you had staggered starts, where you had no idea where the rest of the people were, whether they were in front of you or behind you or, you know, where you were in the field. So I love those races where you run blind. You have no idea. Or 24-hour races where you loop and loop and loop and you don't know who's done what. Though I do very well in those. I do much better in races where there's where the competitive element's gone, because I find it a distraction. It's not a helpful, it doesn't fire me up. So it distracts me negatively, you know, because of course, if you've got, you know, a name in trail running and people start chasing you, the pressure is there to perform. You're not going to just lie down and you know, take it. But so you do push back and fight back and whatever, but it's not my best form.
Would you be happier if you would just go someplace with a bunch of people and run for 6 days and it wasn't really a competition, or is there, do you still need that little bit of competition?
No. Do you know what I really need? And again, this is what adventure racing put in my veins. I need it to be so bloody hard that it doesn't matter what the next guy or girl's doing. It doesn't matter. You are just fighting the course.
Yeah.
You're just trying to survive. Where I like the kind of race where 90% of the people are just trying to finish, because it's so hard. So that's what I like.
So you've done a lot of races. You may not be able to think of it. What's one day that you were like, this is so hard, but I feel it's perfect for me and it's going to hurt everybody else? Is there ever a day like that where you're just like, it's too tough for everybody else?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Actually, can think of lots of days like that, especially in the heat when it gets really, really, really hot. I'm short and I'm smaller frame, and I've got Raynaud's. Do you know what Raynaud's is?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So my blood
circulation.
Blood doesn't quite go to the ends of my fingers. Compromise circulation, which is a real problem when you live in London.
Yeah.
But it is a huge advantage when you're running in the desert. So because your body is slightly cooler somehow. That's my sense anyway than other people. So when it gets really extremely hot, like one particular day in the Sahara, I think it was the Celsius hit about 53 degrees. And that was one of my best running days ever, because when it's really, really hard. And then other times, once I ran in Turkey, and to cut a long story short, what should have been a 90 kilometer day turned out to be a 136 kilometer beast on terrain that we didn't expect at all. And as people were beginning to keel over, I don't know, I always get a sixth gear somewhere when it gets so hard. I'm terrible in the beginning when everybody's sprinting, and first 30 kilometers is hopeless. Forget it. I'm middle of the pack. But I need really, really long distances and tough terrain and the unexpected and extreme heat. And I do very well when you combine those guys.
Yeah. How much of that do you think is physical, and how much is the mental part of like, it's going to be hot, so I'm going to be good? Whereas other people are like, oh, it's hot, I'm going to suffer.
Yeah, I think it's mostly mental, actually. I mean, I try and say it's because I'm smaller frame or whatever, but there's something about not fighting the heat, you know, accepting it. But Randy, I have to be fair. I hate the cold.
Yeah.
Okay, I also did really well in some races in sub-zero temperatures and swimming through mud lakes and whatever. Yeah. So actually, no, it is a question of it's a question of will and mental mental grit, where you just bite into it, you know, don't fight it. Bite into it. It's so cold you have to begin to wrap emergency blankets around your organs to stop from getting hypothermia. But there's something about my one captain used to say, Erica, remember, pain is temporary, quitting lasts forever.
Yep.
And it's a well-known quote, but it really, really stuck with me, because the once or twice in my adventure racing career where we did quit, I suffered for very, very, very long afterwards and regretted it so terribly, because we didn't need to quit. Nobody was dying. All we needed to do was get warm, eat something, and keep going.
Yeah.
Or get cool or whatever it was.
Yeah. Well, that's what Paulette tells herself when she's out. She's like, I'm so miserable, but I'm not going to die, so let's just keep going.
Do you know, Paula has a point, because I always think to myself, gosh, get a life. In Vietnam, they'd be shooting at me right now in the Vietnam War, you know? So, okay, fine. You're a little bit cold and miserable. Nobody's shooting at you. I always use that trick.
Yeah, that's true. True. So, what's harder, a six-day run, five-day adventure race, or writing a book?
Writing a book wasn't hard. It was an absolute... No, please don't let it come out the wrong way.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved the process of writing the book. And it came easy because I think I waited until I was 50 years old and was able to bring something more to it than ego, if I may permit to say so. So writing the book was a wonderful gift during lockdown. I had enough time, and because business was slow, and I decided, instead of bemoaning the fact that business was slow, I would take this precious time and actually do what I that I've been wanting to do for the past 35 years. So I wrote the book. What's harder than between a 5-day adventure race and a 6-day trail run? To be honest, you can't even put them in the same sentence. So it's two different sports. You know, ask trail runners to not sleep, and then you will begin to see the fallout. It's the thing about adventure racing, apart from the fact that it is so wildly multidisciplinary. I mean, one race, we actually had to, we had one, they gave us one horse, Randy, one horse, you know. So one team member got to ride it, and the rest of us got lassoed to the horse. And we, you know, had to sort of learn how to run behind a horse. I mean, it's a wildly multidisciplinary sport. And then it's a team sport, then having to deal with the team dynamics. And, you know, in a normal sport like rugby or cricket, or where you're in a team sport, it's short. It's quite contained, you know. The field stays the same. You can't get lost. Most likely you won't run any risk of dying. Adventure racing is just another ball game altogether. And talking to you, this may actually lead to me racing again. This is a mistake. I should have said no.
I'll accept responsibility for that.
I'll let you know if I do my first race in how many years. I'll let you know.
That would be cool.
Yeah, it is. It's a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah. So you said you wanted to write a book for 15 years. Did you, when you started writing, because you go, this is not a, I did this race, I did that race book. It's, you go really deep into a lot of different areas, which I found very, very interesting. Did you know what you wanted to write when you started, or did all the feelings? People can't see my quotation marks, but I guess that's how I can explain it. did that just kind of become the obvious part of the book?
Yeah. So I had a structure. In the beginning, I thought I was just going to write a very easy reading collection of races that were interesting because they were in exotic locations and with interesting cultures. With some interesting characters. So I wanted it to be a fun and easy read. And then my editor said, where are you in the story? And that people would actually want to hear about the author a little bit more. Mm. And in the process of beginning to write that, I suddenly began to understand what endurance sport had meant to my life. And I understood suddenly that I had to share with the reader really how it chiseled me over the years. And to do that, you know, you have to begin to share a lot. And as I was sharing, I realized actually that these stories could be very helpful for people going through similar things. And you know, Randy, then I thought, what's the point of holding back, you know? Why not just go for it full lock, stock and barrel and share everything that I thought would be useful to share about my life. So it turned into an honest memoir around trail running. So because I kept all the adventure racing tales for the next book, there's going to be a book around the adventure racing, and it's going to be a bit more of a coming of age book and how we shape over our young adult life. It'll be more aimed at younger people, helping them to navigate some troubled waters, you know. But this book in particular actually took me by surprise. And as I allowed the book to shape in my hands, it took on a life of its own. And then eventually the book taught me so much about life and about myself that I never, and about things that I never expected. So it was a huge discovery journey, and it was very exciting to see the story actually emerge without me fiddling with it. You know, it came from outside of me, really, if you can say that. And I've got a little run club here in Cape Town. And for the first 6, 7, 8 months, they were quite excited. Oh, you're writing a book. And then they were like, after a year, are you still writing the book? and the whole thing took until we actually published and released the book yesterday. It took about 2 years in total. Mm. But the book had to finish itself, you know?
Yeah.
I couldn't force it. So I was grateful for the time that I had to put to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's... It wasn't what I expected.
Have you read it?
Oh, yeah. Obviously, yes.
Have you read the whole book? No ways. Where did you get it?
I got it on Amazon like a week ago.
No ways. Okay. Our princess of it. No, I didn't know you read it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well. Yeah. In all honesty, like I read really fast. I mean, I just read fast. I finished it in 2 nights. It was just, well, the first night it was like, I don't know, it's like 11:30. It's like way past my bedtime. I'll finish it tomorrow night. So, no, it's.
Wow, I'm stoked. Wow, I had no idea.
Oh, like, yeah. Yeah.
So
you're
doing your homework, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so I was going to ask you how it's doing, but. You don't know.
What?
I mean,
that was a bit of a funny angle that I didn't know that you read it. I was still trying to sort of tell you about the book without punting it too much because I wanted to.
Well, we don't want it, you know.
Yeah.
To me, you've told the exact right amount of stories.
Say again.
You've told the exact right amount of stories from the book.
Right.
So now people have heard stuff. Yeah, they need to go buy it and read it because they can they can hear the whole story about wrapping space blankets around you to keep warm. That's in the book. So,
but oh,
do you have a sense yet how the book is going to do, how it's been received by people?
Yes, actually, I do. So I asked 12 people I really trust to review the book. And the reviews that I got back from them were really great. And then since yesterday, since the book launch, I've had so many messages of people bemoaning the fact that they didn't sleep last night. you know, one person said she couldn't put it down until 4 a.m. And I suppose it's because, you know, yesterday a lot of my friends came to the launch, so it must be interesting for them to read stuff. I don't talk a lot. You know, I like listening to people. It's only when I'm on the podcast that I talk this awfully much, because it's what you want me to do. But the feedback that I'm getting from people is actually quite astounding. And Rania, and I think the thing that makes me happiest is that people say it's a book devoid of ego. I mean, you know, but it's not an egotistical. I wrote the book with the reader in mind, and because I really wanted the reader to get something from it in the end. And especially people who don't yet run or bike or swim or dance or whatever, to get off the couch and get moving, because it makes a friggin' big difference.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
So you've got your run group there. What else are you doing? You got plans for races? What's coming up?
Yeah. Okay, so next weekend is one of South Africa's iconic trail races, but I don't do very well in these one-day things because I need to, you know, I need to be in a race where you break a little bit and then come through. So in 2 weeks' time, there's Ultra Trail Cape Town. It's a 100-kilometer trail race. It's quite well-known in the international circuit. So, but that's just for training. And then the big thing next year, I missed it this year because of lockdown and there were no qualifying races. So I was hoping to do Spartathlon as I just turned 50. So, I don't know if you guys have spoken on previous programs about Spartathlon, but it's a 250-kilometer beast that you've got to run in 36 hours, basically, with 3,000 meter elevation in Athens, and, you know, at the end of summer, probably 35, 40 degrees Celsius. And you've got to finish it in, I mean, the cutoffs are just inhumane. So 30% of the field finish in a good year. And I've just turned 50, so I'll be 51 next year when I do it. I really want to do that race. I want to finish that race. But yeah, that's the next one.
Yeah. So you keep saying you're 50 like that's old, but it's not. Do you? Well, it's not.
No, it's not old, but yeah. Your body is very different mm-hmm. to when you were younger. Your body is different, Randy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think, maybe not, let's see how I want to put this. So maybe you won't win a race anymore, but do you think you can still race as well as you can?
Yeah.
You know yes. what I mean? You can still reach
I
that.
I know exactly what you mean. So, you know, it's such a beautiful thing because you're right. 50 is not old. So last weekend, there's a race called Three Peaks here also in Cape Town. And it's not that long. It's like, I don't know, 50, 60 kilometers. And lots of young, fast, you know, the young, fast ones. It's a race for them. And I just raced my race and sort of placed in fifth and sixth place the entire race. And you have to climb three really big mountains in succession and then run back down to town. I stuck to my game plan. I raced for the love of it. I enjoyed my running because I raced slowly in the beginning. I didn't try and chase anybody. I didn't try and win anything. And then sort of in the last 10 kilometers, there was one mountain to summit. And I saw the two ladies in fourth and fifth place ahead of me, but in that classic bent over stance, and I knew I was coming from behind. And it was very nice to just click into that next gear. And at the top of the mountain, I overtook both of them. And then it came thundering down the mountain on my 50-year-old knees that needs a lot of glucosamine, you know. But I got that gear and I clicked into the gear and I felt it. And I flew down that mountain and raced into the finishing straight. And okay, I was third. I didn't win the race, but I didn't even expect to place in the top 10 in this particular format. So, yes, I still can. And I'll continue until I have to do it with the Zimmer frame. But I can do it. Yeah.
So, well, that's perfect. I think that may be the best place to end because we're on a high. But so I didn't know exactly where we'd go with this conversation, but it reached all my expectations I knew you would be very interesting, and you are. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Randy, thank you so much for reaching out. I really appreciate it, and thank you for taking the trouble to read my book, and it was lovely to look at your smile and your wonderful blue eyes and to share this mirth, you know, life. Thank you. It is a privilege, actually. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And as soon as you do your next adventure race, you can come back on and you can tell us all about it.
Okay.
How's that for motivation?
I'll take some youngsters with me. That's actually what I want to do.
Be perfect.
Get some kids into the mountains, get them to navigate, get them to test their grit a little. That's what I want. Yeah.
All right. So, well, everybody that's been listening, go buy the book. I'll put a link right in the show notes so they can just click on it and get it and read it and then buy some more and give to their friends for Christmas. So
thanks, Randy. I really appreciate that. Big hug.
Thank you for coming on. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Bye. Thank
you. All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Sounds like you might have heard this before. I know I have. That's because this song is called Alice's Restaurant. About Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant was never the name of a restaurant. That was always the name of the song, which is why I still call it Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Well, it all started about 40 Thanksgivings ago. 40 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in the restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Foxy the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the town dump. We got there, there was a sign, a chain across the road saying, closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump being closed on Thanksgiving before. So with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. And we didn't find one, till we come to a side road. And off of the side of the side road, there was a 15-foot cliff, and at the bottom of the cliff, there was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile'd be better than two little ones. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. And that's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obi. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obi. I cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." It was after talking to Obi for about 45 minutes on the telephone that we finally arrived at the truth of the matter. And Obi said we had to go down, pick up the garbage. We also had to go down and talk to him at the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one of two things that Obi could have done at the police officer station. And the first thing was he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest over the telephone, which wasn't very likely. We didn't expect it. And, of course, the other possibility was that, well, he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't counted on, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, "Obi, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." We sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. Now, friends, I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this was happening. They got 3 stop signs, 2 police officers, and 1 police car. But when we got to the scene of the crime, there was 5 police officers and 3 police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in the newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster tire tracks, footprints, dog smelling prints. And they took 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. They took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, the southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. And it was after the ordeal we went back to the jail. Obie said he's going to put us in a cell. He said, kid, I'm going to put you in a cell. Give me a wallet, your belt. And I said, Obie, I can understand you wanting my wallet, so I don't have any money to spend in the cell. But what do you want my belt for? He said, kid, we don't want any hanging. And I said, Obie, did you think I was going to hang myself for littering? Obie said he was making sure, and friends Obie was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and drown. Took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll, have an escape and get away. Obie was making sure, all right. And it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice... Remember Alice? This is still the song about Alice. She come by and with a few nasty words to Obie on the side, she bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obie come in with the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us, and he sat down. A man come in, he said, all rise, and we stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures, and the judge walked in with a CNI dog. We sat down. Obie looked at the CNI dog, and then at the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows, and looked at the CNI dog. And Obie began to cry, because Obie come to the realization that this was a typical case of American blind justice. And there's no way the judge was going to look at the 27 8x10 colored bell. It didn't matter, because we was fined $25 each, and we had to pick up the garbage in the snow. Of course, that's not what I come to talk about or nothing. Just thought I'd mention it. Thought I'd talk a little bit about the draft. Now, a lot of people think that's just from years ago. But tell that to the guys who've been called back after all that time. Yep. Not only that, they still got that building over in New York City and others like it all across America. And that's where you used to have to go in, get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. And I remember I had to go in there one morning a long time ago for my physical examination. So I got good and drunk the night before, because I wanted to feel my best when I went in that morning. I mean, I wanted to feel, I wanted to look, I wanted to be like the all-American kid. When I went in that morning, I was hung down, I was brung down, I was hung up, I was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking things. I walked in, I sat down. They gave me a piece of paper, said, kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. I went in there, I said, shrink, I want to kill. I want to kill. Want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth, dead bird bodies, I mean kill, kill. And I started jumping up and down, yelling, kill, kill. And he started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, kill, 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 kill. Till the sergeant come over, pinned a medal on me, sent me down the hall saying, you're our boy. I didn't feel real good about it. But I proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, and all kinds of stuff that they was doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2, 3, 4, 5 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. They was inspecting, injecting every single part of me. And they was leaving no parts untouched. But I proceeded through until I finally come to see the very last man. I walked up, I said, "What do you want to see me about?" He said, "Kid, we only have one more question. Have you ever been arrested?" I told him the story of the Alice's Restaurant Massacre with five-part harmony, boom, orchestration. He stopped me right there. He said, "Kid, did you go to court?" I told him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows. He stopped me again. He said, "Kid, I want you to go over, sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid." Over there, Group W. Group W was where they used to put you if you might not have been moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime. There was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly looking people on the bench. I mean, there was mother rapers, father's dabbers, father rapers. There was father rapers sitting there on the bench next to me. I mean, these was mean, nasty, ugly, horrible, crime-fighting guys. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest, the meanest father raper of them all was coming over to me, and he sat down next to me and said, "Kid, what'd you get?" I said, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $25 and pick up the garbage." He said, "Kid, what was you arrested for?" I said, "Littering." They all moved away from me on the bench there. Till I said, "And creating a nuisance." And then they all come back and shook my hand. We had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, who's smoking cigarettes, all kinds of stuff, having a good time. Till the sergeant come over. He had some paper in his hand. He held it up. He went like this. He said, "Kids, this piece of paper got 37 words for them senses. Want to know time, the crime, detail of the crime. You got to say, pretend, tune about the crime. The rest of the officer's name, kind of thing you got to say." And he talked for 45 minutes. And nobody understood a word he said. But we had fun filling out the forms and playing with the pencils on the bench. I wrote down the massacre like I was supposed to, and I put down my pencil. Turned over the piece of paper. And there on the other side of that piece of paper, away from everything else on the other side, I mean underlined and capitalized, read the following words. "Kid, have you rehabilitated yourself?" I went over to the sergeant. I said, "Sergeant, you got a lot of gall to ask me if I've rehabilitated myself. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench. I'm sitting here on the Group W bench because you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, children, villages after being a litter bug." He said, "Kid, we don't like your kind. We're going to send your fingerprints off to Washington. And friends, somewhere in Washington, enshrined in a little folder, is a study in black and white of my fingerprints. The only reason I'm singing you the song tonight is because you may know somebody in a similar situation sometime. I mean, even some of you can be in something like this sometime sooner than you're sitting here thinking about right now. And if you ever find yourself in something like that, you don't know what to do. Well, there may be only one thing you can do. Actually, There may not be anything you can do, but there's something you can try. And that's to be wherever it is you're supposed to be. I mean, you go in there, you sit down, you wait your turn. And when you get a chance, you stand up, you go something like this. You say, "Oh, shrink, excuse me, man, but you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant," and walk out. I mean, imagine one person, even today, walking in, singing some Alice's restaurant, walking out. They're going to say, "Hey, that guy's 40 years too late. Get that guy out of here." Imagine two of them walking in hand, singing in harmony. I mean, I don't know what the policy is, but I guess if you tell them, you ain't going. So, imagine 50, maybe 50 people a day going in, singing some Alice's restaurant, walking out. Friends, they might think it's a movement. And most of them be too young to know what a movement was. But that's what it was. It was the Alice's Restaurant Anti-Massacre Movement. That's what it was, that's what it is, and I guess that's what it's always gonna be. And all you've gotta do to join is to sing it with me as it comes around again on the guitar. With feeling. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, is the roundabout, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. No, no. You can't start singing louder just at the end. Who would have thought after all this time, you would have learned by now. You want to end war and stuff, you've got to learn to sing loud all the time so people can hear you. Now, I know this is a long song. Believe me. But it could be longer. I'm still not proud or tired. Of course, I remember when I was a little kid, I started writing my songs. My dad took me aside one time and said, "Arlo, you know, if you can't be great, it's better to be long." I'm still thinking about that. Anyway, when it comes around again, maybe you can help me out. Here it comes. You can't get anything that's better at Alice's Rest, except in Alice. You can't get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can't get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Da 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 da. At Alice's Restaurant. Thanks so much.